accession number 21050, reel 6.
Major John Semkin, take 3, side 2.
We were talking about maps, and sometimes they were defective because then you saw that it had been taken from an aerial photograph, and where the clouds had been, they'd guessed. And so you found occasional error. But generally speaking, even though we sometimes travel 80 miles in a day when the thing broke, we'd always got 25-thou maps to cover the whole area. And, without them, we'd have been completely lost. Map reading is the essence of the whole game. And you'd have to know where every tank in your squadron was on that map, because you couldn't see him, you see, most of the time. In this thick country,
what size of territory would a tank squadron cover when it was deployed?
Well, I don't know. It depends upon how thick the terrain was, and I suppose we could, if the country was a little open, we could probably cover half a mile with our guns, you see, from left to right. But we were always lumbered with this infantry support role, so that we were simply, they advanced generally on a company front. Perhaps two company fronts, and that's our area of sitting, but our guns would just go as far as you could see. But tank and infantry corps, if they had spent one half of the time they spent devising the DD tank upon working out some sort of system of tank and infantry cooperation, we'd have won the war in half the time. But there we are.
Could the infantry talk to you?
No.
On their nets?
No.
There was no communication system beyond?
No communication system at all.
Somebody's
apart from sort of shouting from the turret to someone on the ground, if you could find him. But of course, the trouble, of course, really with the infantry was that they would set off, and then the enemy defensive fire tasks would be called down, and they'd be shelled. And they'd say, oh, well, that's our guns firing short. Well, it wasn't. It was the enemy firing. And they would go to ground. And once an infantryman, and most of these infantrymen were only sort of 19, 20, that sort of age, once they get on the ground, they're very difficult to get up from the ground. And then their attitude, I think, to us, and it would have been mine too, was, here am I with a bloody rifle, whereas that bloke in that bloody great tank has got two machine guns capable of firing 400 rounds a minute. He's got a gun which is carrying a 14-pound shell. Why the hell doesn't he get on with it? And that, in force, was what, in fact, happened. It was left, really, to the tanks to take the objective. And the infantry came up and sat on it afterwards and dug in and held the position. But they didn't really make any contribution, I think, to the actual fighting during the advance. They were just, in some ways, an embarrassment, because you had to be sure that there was none of them in front of you. And half the time you just took it on trust, and so it proved. The fact is the Germans, of course, worked on the opposite operation. Their tanks were in command, and their Panzer Grenadiers were in support. And if we had done that, I think we'd have gone on far, far better. And we'd have fought as a regiment and not as reduced to piecemeal into separate squadron operations. I mean, the Fontenay-le-Pesnil operation was the only time that I recall in Europe in which we fought as a regiment. Every other time we were just a tank supply agency being palmed out to this brigade, that brigade, the other brigade.
But 8th Armoured was an independent brigade, wasn't it?
Yes, it wasn't part of an armoured division. And so there we were. I suppose they got the infantry and they felt they got to fight an infantry war. But the fact of the matter is, it wasn't an infantry war, it was an armoured war. And it should have been fought as such.
What about civilians in the battle area? Did you come across them?
Never saw them. I mean, it was funny. We were talking to some people in Nijmegen when we went over on a trip. They were saying they remembered this, that. And I said, come off it. I mean, there wasn't a soul in Nijmegen when we were there. And he said, they were, you know. We were all in the cellars. We were so... And after the war, people gave us some photographs which they'd taken through the letterbox and this sort of thing. No, we never saw any. Civilians.
And what about when you got to Germany? Did
well, I left the regiment before we got into Germany. The second Geilenkirchen's in Germany, and of course we saw nothing there. It was part of the Siegfried Line. We didn't ultimately get into Germany until very late on, because we came back from Geilenkirchen, back up to Nijmegen, crossed the Rhine into Holland, and up through Holland. We didn't really get into Germany until the last month or so.
Going back to the Normandy battle. Once the breakout from Air Division Falaise had taken place, what happened during that period to you?
Well, I can remember we finished the Battle of Normandy at the place called just beyond the River Noireau. We had got quite a bloody nose there. And then on 25th of August, I think, it all stopped. The fighting was over. And we moved on to a little village called Saint-Honorine. And the brigadier came and told the colonel, well, you know, he said, that's all over. I mean, you've seen the last of 43 Division, which is 43 Division. We'd been with a lot, and we didn't get on with them at all well. They're commanded by a chap named General Thomas, who was a poisonous creature. And he said, well, you won't be seeing anything of von Thoma until the crossing of the Rhine, you know, the crossing of the Seine. And he thought, it's marvellous. Well, he was quite right, that we crossed the Seine just exactly 10 days later with General Thomas in 43. And so it continued. I mean, 10 days after that, we were in Amiens. 10 days after that, we were up at Oudenaarde, Brussels, Louvain, and onto the Albert Canal at a place called Giel, where we had the bloodiest battle we'd had since the Battle of Zemzem, After that, it was the Arnhem affair, the quick dash up to Grave and Nijmegen, and then, of course, we were We were in battle there because the line behind us was cut and so on, and that went on for some weeks, and then we went over the Rhine on to cross the bridge at Nijmegen, and the whole thing got bogged down until ultimately the remains of the 6th Airborne Division were got out of Arnhem by chaps who, of course, had to get across this terrible country in the teeth of the enemy opposition after the game was known.
And during this period, you were still in command of A Squadron?
Yes, I was still commanding A Squadron then.
And the... Up until... Sorry, I've forgotten the name of the place where you said you had the major battle, but up until that point... what was the nature of the opposition you were facing? Was it?
What is
you
all
were traveling long distances? So presumably it's.
Oh well, we the break came after we crossed the Seine, and then we galloped on, and we used to lose the leading tank every day because the Germans would leave. Some self-propelled guns hidden somewhere, you see, and they would knock off the leading tank, which was disagreeable for the chap whose turn it was to lead that day. But our route right up is sort of marked by the graves of young men, but we went scalding up, and. On to Brussels and so on into Holland, but the and then we from Nijmegen we went down to Geilenkirchen, and from Geilenkirchen we went back to Nijmegen, and then it was the Rhine. But I was out of it by that time. I was sent back to England.
What point was that?
After the Geilenkirchen battle, just about Christmas time of 1944.
Mm-hmm. And why were you sent?
Well, I was very ill by that time. Very ill. And of course, we were confronted now with a most appalling winter. And I mean, we'd been 3 years in the Middle East. I mean, the weather was a terrible burden to us. But there we are. So but the regiment went on and went on and went on and went on, and was it 11 months before the end of the fighting finally came, and we were getting people killed in the last month who'd been with us ever since the horse days.
But when you returned to England, you didn't actually go back to the regiment?
No, when I came back to England, I was sent to Bovington, to the training regiment there, where I was put in charge of the sort of tactical squadron. And then when that folded up, I went for a while to the Octu, which was moved from Sandhurst to Bovington, and after a few weeks there, I went to chief instructor to Catterick, and from there I was discharged in May of 1946, I suppose.
And since then, have you sort of had any further commitments, military commitments?
No, none at all, except the regimental association, the old comrades association and so on, which is very active.
Now, I understand you got the MC at some stage.
Well, I got that, I really got it for being, everybody who commanded a squadron got an MC sooner or later, but the excuse was my knocking out the Tiger. Got it for that. And I got the Silver Star for Geilenkirchen from the Americans.
And what was What was their rationale for that? Why did they decide to give you the Silver Star?
Well, because I was commanding a squadron. They gave one to the colonel and to the three squadron leaders, which was very kind of them.
And how did winning the MC go down with the rest of the regiment? Did everybody think it was long overdue?
Well, the point that it was this business of decorations is a very tricky affair. I worked on the principle that after every battle I put in the senior sergeant who hadn't got an MM for an MM. And you know, one sort of invented the citation. And while, so that everybody knew that if he stuck it out long enough as a tank commander, he'd get a gong, you see. Now, the trouble with officers is that in the desert, I think only one chap below the rank of major got an MC. You know, everybody had to get him. Oh yes, the doctor got one, and the technical adjutant got one, and the squadron leaders got them, and the colonel got his DSO, and the chap who at the Battle of Alam Halfar, who went round from burning tank to burning tank hauling people out, he got one. But apart from that, no one at the troop leader level got a gong. But in Europe, it became slightly more erratic. But I tried to keep to the system of putting in the sort of senior man, you see. But then it doesn't upset things. While it goes by senior, the longest, if you get your gong for long service, that's something everybody understands, that's okay. But if you start giving gongs to someone who's newly arrived, as my successor did, he gave a gong to someone who'd only been with us 5 minutes, it rankles to this day and is resented, and he's embarrassed by it too. No, this decorations business is something I feel very strongly about, because, I mean, one of my troop leaders, when they're handing in their medals at the end of the war, he refused to apply for his on the grounds that the ATS were getting the same medals. And you see, the Germans, the Americans, had a thing, for example, a combat infantryman's badge. Now, if you were a combat infantryman's badge, that sort of came over the top. You know, it was a brass musket. And when Colonel Gavin's memorial service in Nijmegen and his decorations were paraded, you know, it was his combat infantryman badge that was at the top, you see. The Germans are the same. They had a combat badge for tanks and for artillery and everything else. And you could get them in bronze and ultimately for silver. Now, we had nothing of that kind. And it's absolutely monstrous that chaps in my squadron who fought in every battle, as one chap at least did, every battle from Alam Halfar right through to the end of the war gets nothing except, you know, the ordinary campaign medals, same as they give to the ATS. Nothing to distinguish them. And then there's nothing to distinguish people either who got terribly wounded. Now, the Yanks give them all this Purple Heart. Well, now, I think that if you're terribly mutilated, it would help a lot if you had a sort of little thing in your coat, you know, like other continental countries. If you have the Legion of Honor, well, you have a red ribbon which you wear in your lapel, you know. And I think that if you'd been mutilated in the war, I mean, one of my troop leaders had his nerve severed in his neck, and the result is his face is lopsided, and he can only laugh like this. See, well now, if he had a little badge to show that he got it in the war, fighting, well, I think that would have helped him a lot. But we have nothing at all. And now I believe they've even got the crazy idea that they're going to give everybody MCs. I mean, that's absolute madness. Because, I mean, the result is that what are you going to do is between sergeants who never lead. It's always the troop leader who takes the knock and runs the risk. But the troop leader goes with him for battle after battle. Well, you give him... You've got to have something to give these chaps.
Who presented the decoration to you? In the field, or was it?
Oh, I think we've got Monty had a sort of gathering, and actually Monty worked very hard on that sort of thing. In fact, over there on that chair, I've got two photographs, both signed by him. One of him actually pinning the thing on the front, and the other with a group, with him in the group who received decorations on that day. The chaps who received their decorations, anyway, I don't know about the officers, but the sergeants and other ranks who got decorations in North Africa, they went to the palace while we were during the few months that we were in England before the war, and received their decorations anew there. But I mean, the actual medal sort of came through the post with a sort of duplicated thing saying, please sign this receipt.
I think that probably covers most of the questions that I have. Is there anything that you think that we haven't covered this morning?
I don't know. As I say, it was an awful... And the fact of the matter is, of course, that one's memory is very erratic. I can't really remember just how one lived in these various conditions. I mean, I was asking, did we used to get a cup of tea before we set off at 3 a.m? And he said, no, we used to sort of cook it up in the tank. And it was, God, it's... setting off before dawn, your heart, you know, you really do feel low, that it's so cold and bloody miserable. Well, there we are. It's all over, but it took a hell of a long time. And as I say, it goes on and on and on, and it tears the heart out of you.